Excuse me. This time we're on record in Gregory versus Stallings, matters before the court for oral argument. Brianna Rozier is arguing on behalf of Jonathan Gregory, and on behalf of respondent Eileen and Richard Stallings, Jared Harris will argue. Are there any preliminary matters by either party?
No, Your Honor.
No, Your Honor.
Very well, you may proceed, Ms. Rozier.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, this court should overturn the lower court's decision, and I'm going to focus on just two reasons today. The first being that there is a dispute of material fact that exists here, and the second reason is that the discovery rule, there should be a discovery rule that is at least applied in summary judgment proceedings. Our brief also does address estoppel, and if the court does have any questions, I'm happy to take those, but I will not be focusing on that in my argument today. Before I get into the heart of my argument, I just want to emphasize the standard that is in place for summary judgment. That standard is that if there is a dispute of material fact that exists, the district court should not dismiss a case based on summary judgment. And that standard is based on facts that reasonable minds may disagree on. Why that's so important is that summary judgment is obviously in place so that we can help the courts run more efficiently. We can be able to be aware of cases that are frivolous or don't have any merit and not clog up the court system. But generally, we don't want to take cases that have merit or potentially could have merit out of the hands of the jury. And that is what's happened in this case. There is a dispute of material fact. As it talks about in the briefs, there is a dispute about when the breach of this contract occurred. And I think the best example of why this matters is Spence v. Howell. There the court recognized that there could have been a couple of different instances where the breach occurred, but they went with the later date in determining whether or not to dismiss the case. That wasn't a summary judgment motion, but similarly, that is the determination they made the latest date. And when you're making decisions on summary judgment, we should be making decisions based on the facts most favorable in light of the non-moving party. In this case, Mr. Gregory did present evidence that he was aware that of the breach sometime after the breach allegedly occurred previously. However, in the case of contracts where there is no time frame of what can happen, then that should be a reasonable time frame. And Mr. Gregory did find out that notice within a reasonable time frame of expecting to get paid off. This isn't a case of, you know, just simple goods being exchanged and being paid out for. This was the process of land and a business venture that occurred prior to selling the land. So obviously there was a lot of moving parts of when this final payout would have occurred. And Mr. Gregory waited a reasonable amount of time for that payout to occur. And once he did have notice, he did file this complaint within the statute of limitations of that notice that the defendants were intending to breach the contract.
Ms. Rozier, what facts do you rely upon to establish that it was a reasonable amount of time?
So the facts that I would rely upon in this case is that there was some evidence that there was discussions presented, at least in the affidavits of the affidavit of Mr. Gregory, that there was representations made that the payouts would come in at least two draws. He did get notice when the first payout did occur, but he was under the impression that there would be a second payout. And he also indicated that he did have representations that he would be the last one paid. I recognize that it would have been about 9 months that had passed, and like I said, I think it would be a jury would be appropriate to determine when that reasonable amount of time had passed, because.
Chief, did we lose Mr. Harris?
So I think we did.
Yes, we did.
If you'll please hold on a second, Ms. Rozier. Mr. Harris, welcome back.
Thank you. It's nice to be back.
All right. Ms. Rozier, are you prepared to proceed?
Yes. Yes, Your Honor.
May proceed. Thank you.
And to continue answering your question, which is what evidence are we relying on then the reasonability of the time frame that it passed in the contract? First of all, I do believe that that is a factual question of whether it was reasonable or not. But in regards to evidence, Mr. Gregory did indicate that he was relying on statements that have been made by the Stallings as well as by their attorney while he was waiting for the payouts. And obviously that evidence would need to be looked at by a jury to decide if that was a reasonable evidence to rely on while waiting for the final payout in this case.
On summary judgment, the district court noted that you were relying on some of the course of the dealings, and in his decision, didn't cite any authority, but in his decision, he said that whether or not they engaged in a similar course of conduct with regards to land development in the past is not relevant insofar as the statute of limitations is concerned. Is that a correct statement of law?
I don't believe that is a correct statement of law. It's the course of dealings are important in determining when there is, the course of dealings are important in determining when the statute of limitation, especially in a case like this, where the contract did not have a time frame to be relied upon. We need to use the course of dealings to determine what the parties would expect in a case like this.
Madam, could I interrupt? You indicate reasonableness is the linchpin of this case. It seems to me that when the property was sold, Mr. Stallings indicated that there would be two payouts, which you've acknowledged, and the one took place immediately, and Mr. Gregory understood that he would get paid last. And so then there was a written document given to him saying the next payout will be January or February of 2013. Is that not, in fact, the two payouts that Mr. Gregory is talking about? And as such, isn't he on notice that we haven't had that payout? And as a result, why doesn't the statute run from that date?
So my understanding, your characterization of the facts is correct, Your Honor, that he did get notice that there would be the next payout in February. However, once the payout occurred, Mr. Gregory was under the impression that there were other people to be paid, that there were mortgage lenders to be paid. And so that process still needed to occur even after the second payout. And so I think there still should be a reasonable amount of time that that is given to the benefit of the Stallings to be able to pay that out prior to Mr. Gregory being able to bring suit.
Excuse me.
So that's why that I would not agree that was the original, that should be the date where the statute runs.
At the time of the sale of the property, there was a very long list of quote unquote investors, lenders, et cetera, who were paid out at the time of the sale. As such, how could it be reasonable that Mr. Gregory would think there are others without an affidavit which specifically indicates those parties who money was also to be paid out?
In this case, it would be reasonable because Mr. Gregory had stepped away from a lot of the work that was happening with the property. So To answer your question in regards to the affidavit, we don't have an affidavit that states that there were other parties or anything like that, but it would be reasonable for him, who is somebody who is no longer managing the property, who's no longer managing the sales, who's waiting for this person who he went into this venture with to wrap everything up, to pay everyone out. And so it is, I think it's reasonable for him to believe that that wasn't a comprehensive list, especially when the time had passed and he still hadn't received a payout. And I also, even though he did get notice that the next payout was expected in February, he had been given notice that there had been some delays. And so he was not also not aware that that, if that February date actually happened. And so he was relying, especially in this kind of negotiation between these two parties where things were in a lot of ways casual, and where they were just relying on the good faith of the other person to act. I think it was reasonable in this case for him to wait a little bit longer to see if he received that payout.
So I want to follow up on the chief's question, Ms. Rozier. So the document that I'm looking at is dated December 27, 2012, and says next payout end of January or 1st of February 2013. Could Mr. Gregory have brought suit on the 2nd of February when he wasn't paid on the 1st of February?
No, Mr. Gregory could not bring suit at that time because he still would have to give a, there still needs to be a reasonable amount of time based on the course of dealings for Mr. Stallings to give that payout. Even if there was...
Why he couldn't have brought suit on the 2nd of February when he has a document that says the last payout will be paid essentially no later than the 1st of February 2013. Why couldn't he bring the suit then?
Well, my biggest concern would be that once again, that he hasn't had that reasonable time for the payout. And the document doesn't specifically say, this is when you will get your payment. If that was the case, I think it'd be very clear cut. But instead it just says, this is the next time we'll get the payout from the buyer. And where Mr. Gregory was relying on the Stallings to make these payments, to wrap up all the dealings.
But doesn't the document say that the amount to be paid to John, and I assume that's John Gregory, is $155,482.28. And I mean, isn't there an implication that he's owed that money and that that will be forthcoming on the latter part of January or first part of February?
In regards to, I think you could make that assumption. Someone could make that assumption. However, I think it goes back to, this is a, when you're determining issues of reasonability, did Mr. Gregory reasonably rely on waiting for that payout? I think that would be something a jury would need to decide, and that's why it should not be dismissed on summary judgment. I think a reasonable person could still believe that was not necessarily the day that Mr. Gregory was going to get paid out. That was just the time frame that they're expecting to get the payment to Stallings, and then what other things need to be wrapped up would be wrapped up at that time.
One of the background issues in this case, because when I first started into it, I said, well, why isn't this just a partnership windup? And as such, the parties both indicated that we needed to have a contract because of certain IRS issues. Do you know the timing of the IRS investigation of either Stallings or Gregory? And was that during this time period in 2012?
Your Honor, I'm not aware of what the length of that IRS investigation was, but there was an IRS investigation around this time, 2012, 2013, of at least Mr. Gregory. And I believe that's indicated in one of the, and in the exchange where Mr. Stallings indicates he won't be paying anything out, he indicates that he was contacted by the IRS in regards to Mr. Gregory's account, which had to do with tax payments. It wasn't, it didn't have anything to do with the actual property itself per se, but it gets implicated because of issues that he had with his taxes. And so there is material fact that does exist here. There's a dispute. And because there is this reasonableness standard, I think we should be very cautious before taking that out of the hands of the jury and in just determining that it would be completely unreasonable for Mr. Gregory to behave the way he did in bringing suit. In regards to the discovery rule, I recognize that our opening brief wasn't quite clear what we were asking for. In regards to the discovery rule, we're not asking the court to create a new rule. We're not asking the court to change precedent. We're just asking the court to apply particularly a discovery standard when determining summary judgment cases. This is what was done in Spence v. Howell. And because of that, that allows the integrity of the summary judgment to stand. We allow the jury to make the decision, this is when the breach occurred, and this is when the statute should run accordingly. And so using that discovery rule, it could just be used as an earmark for judges as they make those determinations to make sure they're not pulling things out of the hands of juries. And I think that's what this case all comes down to. Was the case prematurely pulled by this summary judgment? What implication that has? A lot of the case law surrounding statute of limitations in regards to oral contracts, things like that, show a lot of time has elapsed between when they could file and when they chose to file. And those are obvious cases. In this case, less than a year had passed between when he got that original statement and when he got notice that there was going to be a breach. It hasn't been a significant time period. And so I think a reasonable juror could find that their breach did occur later than that original statement. And so in pulling those material facts to be determined by a jury, that's a standard that can cause some precedent where individuals are not being able to have their claims heard by a jury because we're pulling things so early just based on what a judge determines reasonable instead of a jury. And so with that, I will reserve the rest of my time for a rebuttal.
Well, thank you, ma'am. Sir, on behalf of the respondent.
Your Honors, I appreciate the opportunity of being here. May it please the court and counsel. I have the Stallings here with me in my office. I don't want to have two more squares on the screen, so they are not on video, but they are here with me. Your Honors, I guess I see this case a little differently than counsel does. This is a straight up application of a statute of limitations. Statute of limitations are a bright line. You either filed in time or you didn't. In this case, they clearly did not. I don't think there's any dispute that they could have filed the lawsuit on December 21st of 12 when the Stallingses got paid. Mr. Gregory acknowledged that he knew about the closing. I can give you the cite to the rule to the record if you want that. He did nothing. Then there were notices sent out by Mr. Stallings. The final notice was on August 27th. I'm not going to pay him anything. Now he takes the position, Mr. Gregory takes the position that, well, I didn't get that notice, even though it came to his attorney, I didn't get that notice until September 9th. Well, that doesn't start when his counsel receives notice doesn't start the statute of limitations. That's what they would argue. That's what they are trying to argue. That's when it started the statute of limitations. That's not the law. The law is upon the breach, when he didn't get his money, when he could have sued, is when the statute starts. And that's December 21st. Now, there are other possible dates that you could argue. Okay, you got December 27th when he sends the notice out saying, hey, you may get a payment in, in January, February. There's the August time, August 27th. Hey, I'm not going to pay you. All of those came and went without Mr. Gregory filing a lawsuit. Now, I also just want to note that in their counsel in their arguments have referenced in the briefing several times and even in the argument today, a representation by Mr. Sand, alleged representation by Mr. Sandow to Mr. Gregory. That issue was presented in an affidavit, and it was decided by Judge Simpson that he would not consider it. It's hearsay, and so it is not considered by the trial court and shouldn't be considered here either. Not that it really matters. I mean, I don't think you can hide behind even an erroneous statement by counsel to get around a statute of limitations. So, Your Honors, we assert that it's clear there is no factual issue on when they could have filed a lawsuit. If they had wanted interest, for example, when would they have asked interest to start? When he could have gotten paid, when he should have been paid? December 21st. On the discovery rule, the request to impose a discovery rule, this court has ruled many times that you aren't doing that, haven't done that, and aren't going to do that. So I don't know that you want any argument on that. I would note that the Spence case, that case got tried. A jury decided that the statute had not run. Because I acknowledge that when a statute can start or should start is a fact issue. I acknowledge that. It's just not disputed here. There is no dispute as to it. And Justice Mueller, you had asked about the course of dealing. I believe that the record is Mr. Gregory had a course of dealing with other finance companies and investors, not Mr. Stallings. So this was their first deal, and hence the course of dealing, it wasn't the course of dealing between them. As to Mr. Gregory and others, yes, but not on this side.
Ms. Rozier's made an interesting point in her argument in urging us, when we create a standard that's based on reasonableness, to perhaps give consideration to letting the jury decide that. I think she's referencing language like from Swofford versus Huntsman Springs, where it talks about a reasonable time will be implied. And she's wondering why we should let judges decide whether time is reasonable or not. You want to respond to that?
Sure. You know, the legislature set a statute of limitations of 4 years here. They have determined that's what's reasonable. And here, there is more than 3 years worth of notice to him that you're not going to get paid. If you took the August 27th email, there are cases that I think it was the Swofford case says you're outside the. It's not reasonable to wait that long. At some point, the court, as a matter of law, can determine what's reasonable and what's not. And here, you don't even need to get to that analysis because the statute is clearly passed.
So, Mr. Harris, you suggested that Mr. Stallings' August 27, 2013 email, in which he said he wasn't going to pay Mr. Gregory, was sent to Mr. Gregory's lawyer. What day was it that Mr. Gregory's lawyer received that email?
From the email, it appears that was September 9th. That's what it appears. It's not exactly clear, but that's what it appears.
If that's the first notification to Mr. Gregory that Mr. Stallings is not going to pay the debt, wouldn't Mr. Gregory's suit be within the 4 year statute of limitations?
I don't believe so. Because he could have sued.
Let's assume those facts are true, that the first notification that Mr. Stallings provides to Mr. Gregory's lawyer is September 9th, 2013. Isn't the suit brought within 4 years of that date?
The suit was brought within 4 years of that date. However, the problem is the statute of limitations doesn't get triggered by when a party says to the other party, I'm not going to pay you. That's not what starts the statute. The statute starts as to when they could sue, which in this case is December 21st. There are frequently cases where the party never says, I'm not going to pay you. And if Mr. Stallings had never said that, would the statute still not have run today? No. He could have brought, I mean, Mr. Gregory could have brought a lawsuit on December 21st, didn't. Whether or not Mr. Stallings gives him formal notice that I'm formally breaching, is largely irrelevant. Because the test is, when could he have brought a lawsuit? Not, when was he put on notice that you aren't going to get paid?
Well, wasn't there an agreement between Mr. Stallings and Mr. Gregory that Mr. Gregory would not be paid on the 21st of December, 2012?
No, that is not the party's agreement. If you look at the pleadings, they're pretty vague here, okay? We sent discovery, they answered discovery, and it's in the record, I can cite it if you'd like. The agreement was they were gonna equally divide the proceeds. That's the agreement as per Mr. Gregory. The agreement was not, we'll let Mr. Stallings get paid first and then I'll take whatever's left over. That's not the agreement, at least not as alleged by them. So that may be what Mr. Stallings was trying to dictate to Mr. Gregory. I get that, but that doesn't mean that was the party's agreement.
Sir, a point of clarification, please. You have given us additional citations, and I think our rule says if you give us additional citations, you need to also point to the issue that citation is pointed to. You did not do so in that regard. Could you explain how Day versus State applies in this case, sir?
I'd be happy to, Your Honor. I assume that counsel was going to talk about the equitable estoppel, and the equitable estoppel, Day case tweaked the equitable estoppel argument a little bit because it created a second exception for the statute of limitations, the waiver exception. I don't think waiver directly applies, but I thought we were going to be talking about that case, and so I wanted to, if it came up, I wanted to be able to talk about it here. I recognize that she's not argued about it. So I don't think waiver applies to this in this situation, but it did. I know in my briefing, I'd quoted Farrow, I think I'm pronouncing that right, you know, that there was only one exception and that has now changed to the two exceptions. I would like to point out on the equitable estoppel argument, I noted in the district court that it had not been pled. The district court didn't disregard it because of that. And also in my briefing in front of the justices, I also noted that the equitable estoppel had not been pled. And I did cite a case, the Maroun, M-A-R-O-U-N versus Wireless Systems at 141 Idaho 604. I didn't quote it for this proposition, but it also states that basically that if you don't plead it, you can't raise it on summary judgment or for the first time on appeal. The district court should not have considered the equitable estoppel argument. It was not pled. I don't think it mattered, obviously, because we prevail on summary judgment anyways, but it's not properly in front of that court or in front of this court.
Why would a plaintiff plead equitable estoppel? I mean, it seems to me it's a defense to an affirmative defense. Statute of limitations is an affirmative defense.
They knew from the get-go that a statute of limitations defense was going to be applied here. It was clearly on an issue from the beginning. It's not, I think
the plaintiff has to anticipate the affirmative defense in the before the answer is even filed.
I think that they could have, it's a really good question. I think that what should have happened is they could have moved to amend after the defense was asserted to say, here's our defense to the statute of limitations. Because what's the problem is there are several elements to the equitable estoppel that have never been pled. And so you'll see in my summary judgment reply, and even in briefing in front of this court, we're talking about what they could have pled to get around to make the equitable estoppel argument apply. And that's the problem, because it wasn't pled. We don't know exactly what they would have pled. We're all in the briefing, we're guessing what they would have said in their pleadings. So I think the appropriate way to handle it would have been for them to move to amend, to assert their defense to the statute of limitations. And in any event, as set forth in my brief, with the equitable estoppel, because Mr. Gregory had well over 3 years to file his lawsuit, had there been estoppel, that right ended. Unless there's any other questions.
There to be none, and thank you, sir. Ms. Rozier, you're on mute, madam. Very good.
Thank you. I do want to address the purpose of statute of limitations. I do recognize that statute of limitations are a hard line rule, and the legislature has put those in place so that people aren't anticipating suits for a long, long time. There's obviously a real purpose around the statute of limitations. However, those statute of limitations still needs to be a determination of when those statute of limitations run. And in this case, the December date is premature for when those statutes run. And if Mr. Gregory had brought a suit at that time, more evidence could have been presented that it was premature, in the sense that representations have been made about when these payouts were going to occur. And I think that's the concerning thing by using that as your date for the statute of limitations. If he had brought it and then it got dismissed because it was premature, that would have been problematic just as well. And so that's why I go back to there is a reasonableness standard here of when that payout should have occurred, and that should be the standard we're applying when we're starting that statute of limitations. And briefly, just about the equitable estoppel, about the things that were brought up, in regards to putting that into the pleadings, I do agree that it doesn't, where we contend that we were within the statute of limitations, requesting equitable estoppel doesn't make a lot of sense to me within the pleadings, and it was brought up on the motion for summary judgment response. And while a certain amount of time has passed since Mr. Gregory did have notice that there was going to be a breach, he still was under the belief system that was within the statute of limitations. So he was diligently pursuing. Clients make lots of choices of when they choose to bring a suit, based on their financial situation, based on a lot of different situations. And so they're also relying on the statute of limitations in determining when to bring that suit. So I think it's, if he reasonably believed that he was within the statute of limitations, I don't see why that would prevent him from claiming estoppel in this case where it was outside of that time frame. So for these reasons, we request that the court overturn the lower court's decision, allow this case to be remanded, and continue to proceed forward. Thank you.
Well, thank you. At this point in time, the matter is now under advisement. We thank counsel for appearing here today pursuant to Zoom. And this matter is under advisement. We'll render a decision. Thank you very much. Court's in recess.
Thank you.